Any more questions? Any questions, anybody? Any old thing? Any pop up? Yes.
Just going back to animals, dealing with the, what you call it, you say the animals are stuck there doing that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what was you?
I'm interested in the animal karma and a guide dog.
I understand. So, okay. I keep it like this. We're done now. Okay, let us think of sentient beings in general and include that as a label, at least for the animals and humans that we know. Forget the other sentient beings that we would also assess that are there. So when we think of the ones we see, so let's think of, like, say, a dog and a lion and a human, for example. So I think naturally we can already see, if we look at dogs, we can say they're the same as us insofar as they have power struggles, they have jealousy, they get angry, some are high, some are low, victims, bosses. It's really the same. So we introduce those delusions. You've got attachment, they're hungry and needy for things. They've got jealousy, they've got anger. It's the same. We can see the same. So the Buddhist model refers not just to us, but to all of them equally. The same model exactly refers. So if you take the model of the mind we were discussing, you've got the neurotic states of mind under the first heading, the negative, delusional, ridiculous, the embellishments, the bells and whistles, the adventitious ones, the rubbish ones that we can get rid of. This is Buddha's amazing finding, that are the source of our pain and why we harm others. And then you've got the valid ones, compassion, intelligence. The main one here, all the other ones, okay, the essence of the main one, the essence of the virtuous or positive ones, is a capacity to see things from another point of view. It's really, this is coming to the wisdom teachings now, it's the ability to see, to put together cause and effect, to put together interdependence, to put together that things exist interdependently. Do you understand? So one time somebody asked His Holiness, how do you apply emptiness? And I know we haven't heard these before, we won't know what it means, but never mind, it's the wisdom teachings. How do you apply emptiness in daily life? He said, see it from another point of view. So if we look at the delusions, and their key function is this absolute concrete rigidity. This is how it is. So when I'm really attached, my mind is narrow and fixated on one thing. Talk about obsessive compulsive, that's attachment. And we only can see right that. We can't see any nuance, we can't see any little bit of this, maybe a bit of that. It's just this total fanatical obsessive. That's the nature of all the delusions. They're completely rooted in ego grasping, and its main function is absolute concreteness, absolute fixedness. Absolute interdependent, unmoving, unspacious. Do you understand? That's the nature of all the neuroses. That's why we suffer. Like the mind becomes rigid, concrete, can see nothing from any other point of view. This is how it is, and that's the nightmare. Can you see that? Now, as soon as your mind becomes virtuous, if we know that it's spacious, you can, when you hear another person's experience, that your own stuff's out of the way enough to even hear what they're saying, so you have empathy. Do you understand? That's because it's virtue. So you might be hungry for some dinner, but you'll subdue that while you're listening to the other person's experience. But if you're a junkie, even as a human, if you're a junkie, you'll be so distracted, won't you? Because all you're doing is obsessed with getting your food. You won't be able to be kind to another person. You can't see from any other point of view. Now, if you're a lion, well, honey, I'm sorry. Don't get near a lion that's hungry, because you will be breathless. Because it has no possibility, if it's only got access to its neuroses, its massive ego grasping, its massive attachment, its massive anger, its massive other ones, and the habit to kill, which is Mummy Lion's method of getting breakfast, that's her programming, isn't it? Then they are completely running her mind. She cannot access any sense of empathy, connectedness. Unless she's got a full belly and she's got some special karma with her baby, she will have a connection and she'll be kind to her baby with that karma connection between them. But if she gets really hungry, she'll eat her baby. It accepts her empathy that much. Do you understand my point? So delusions are there and they're concrete and they're rigid and they're solid and they're the nightmare. But here as a human, we can access our virtue and kindness and intelligence and self-saving. The lion has it all there underneath, but they're buried under the weeds of her neuroses. And she's in a body and having a mind such that she cannot access that. That's the tragedy of the lion, the animal's mind. So if you're born as a domestic animal, You're a dog. Okay? You've got an animal birth, a generalized agreement, similar to the lion, but you've got different tendencies, haven't you? You've got very different tendencies. Clapside animals eat koalas eat eucalyptuses. They don't eat each other. Lions happen to kill and eat. That's their thing. But some animals don't. I mean, all animals will end up killing their predator. Okay. That's a natural, that's a real fact of panic and anger, you know, and fear. But some have different tendencies. So some animals are really sweet and cute. You know, there's a friend in Melbourne who got a new little dog, and she just doesn't bark. She's got cute little minds. Even when she hears other dogs bark, she's all kind of cute and happy. She doesn't have much anger. It's obvious. She's got lots of attachments. So we've all got these different tendencies. So unless a guide dog is trained, due to her own karma, that guide dog is born with a Labrador, which is animal karma, but due to other tendencies of helping others, she's born with a tendency to be trained to help other people. But she can't make a choice and then go and study science. Do you have my point? But she's got some tendency in there. Do you see my point? So of course you create virtue, that's marvelous. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
thank you. Okay. Well, some of us, yeah.
It seems like some animals have a capacity for compassion greater than our own. I'm sorry.
Say something. Give an example.
Like an emperor penguin that marches across.
Like a what?
An emperor penguin in Antarctica that marches across an entire continent.
Yes.
In freezing winter.
Yes.
To get food and then marches all the way
back.
No,
but that's maybe 99% karmic tendency. They just do that because they're programmed to do it. They're just doing it because you're programmed. And most of us are just doing what we're programmed to do from past life with no awareness of it. No, like we'll walk 5 miles to go get a cup of tea if we're really thirsty. And it's not out of compassion, it's out of attachment. They're just programmed to do it. They're programmed, not thinking of their baby every second. It's just they're programmed to do it. That's karmic imprints. We can put the narrative on top of it, perhaps, with our mind. But using this Buddhist model, it's just a habit to do. So it's what a dumb life to have to walk 6 months to dinner. We want an awful life to have, and they've got the perseverance just to keep doing it. Because that's what karma does, we just get propelled to do the habit. Like people who run 27 miles, have a habit to run. Probably they've been a jogger before, and they're a bit of ignorance, they get bored and bloody angry, you know. But if you see a dog, you will go and save a baby. They do that. Even that's the habit. That's what I'm talking about the guide dog. It's not as if the guide dog is sitting there thinking, wow, you know. Or the people. It's programmed with it from past karma, so it just acts it out. So it is ending up being beneficial, but there's no thought every second of my baby's starving, I must hurry. Not like that.
Is it then analogous to that boy you talk about with the lice in his hair?
Which one?
The boy with the lice in his hair.
He was programmed. He came out just like with compassion. But that's real compassion. Because he could articulate it, and he could see the suffering, and he was in tears, and he just didn't do it once or twice, and also he could grow it, because he had intelligence, whereas a penguin can't grow it, I would suggest. The lion can't grow it. So two things there. The Buddhist view is two things. One is your karmic habits from past practice. So two is the different states of mind that you have now that you can access. So the Buddha's view is saying you've got karmic habit to be a guide dog, you've got the karmic habit to save the baby, you've got the karmic habit to be a penguin to go 6 months to get dinner, or whatever, and come back and, you know, the daddy sits there with the egg and all that. It's a very moving story, isn't it? It's also so wonderful in the movie. It's just wonderful. But you're then born, as a human, you're born also with all those habits, plus now the delusions, but plus also the virtues, and they're the ones we can use to change the situation. Whereas the penguin's stuck with what it is and it can't change. That's the real one. It has habits, yes, and they might be compassion. I mean, even you read stories about like a lion nurturing a mouse. You see stories, you know, on YouTube. That's just because of some strong karmic connection between those two sentient beings that it overrides even their not sex. What do you call it?
Instinct.
No.
Species.
Huh?
Species.
Yeah, species, thank you. Did it make sense? Good. Oh, question. Yes, Lizzie.
Okay. I've got a question about reincarnation, and I've heard you say many times we've all had clairvoyance countless times, but we've lost it.
Yeah, the Buddha would say we've all done. There's nothing we haven't done before. So I'm trying to sort of illustrate that we've got lots of lifetimes. And we would have done spiritual practice in the past, and we would have got super point of concentration, we would have achieved samadhi, and we would have clairvoyance. We've achieved all these realizations. We've had amazing realizations, but we haven't gone all the way and used that mind to realize emptiness and cut the root of delusion, so we fall down again and forget it and practice next again.
So So it's not until you realize emptiness
you just keep
losing all the realization.
Precisely, exactly. Okay. You get almost at the top of the mountain, you fall down again. That's
right.
Exactly right. So when you realize emptiness and cut the root, then it can never grow again.
So in this life, if you're sort of slowly plodding along and progressing and chipping away so slowly, does that mean next life you just wake up and, granted you might, you know, hopefully die peacefully and get a human rebirth again, will you wake up and start off where you left off, or might just be like you've lost it all again, you've got to...
Depends on many things,
isn't
it? It depends on many things.
Yeah.
And keep nurturing those seeds and keep them fresh and nourished.
And purified.
But no, one thing is, if you really practice them, if you see, okay, it's two separate things here. Okay. The seed analogy is good. You practice living a very strong life of morality, living in vows, intentional killing, non-harming, non-stealing, doing lots and lots of practices that are very potent practices. You might not see much result now, but you're going to see masses of results next life. You're going to multiply next life, so you can leap ahead, you know. If you do it wisely and know what you're doing, you can leap ahead next time. So negativity also multiplies too. If you keep it small now, then it multiplies in the future as really heavy. Do you understand? So both will multiply.
Thank you.
Yes. Great. Thank you. Pass it. Just pass it through the chairs. Pass it through. Give it to people. Pass. There you go. Pass it through the tables. Going around. Pass it through the tables. Go a direct line. Go like birds. One full crow as the crow flies. Get on.
First of all, Rabina, thank you.
Yes. Who's that person behind you? What's your name? Who are you, darling? Who are you?
Alice.
Alice. I'm happy to meet you, Alice. Are you enjoying the teachings? I'm very happy, sweetheart. Go, Dad.
First of all, Rabina, thank you so much. That was a wonderful meditation.
Okay.
And your presence, or not, I'm sure you were part here, but that was wonderful to be able to do a little bit more meditation. My thing is, you know, the Christians say that God put the animals on the earth for our enjoyment. I wonder, I'd be interested, because I was brought up a Catholic too, before I said goodbye to God myself, and... goodbye to God, I didn't quite know what direction I was going
after
that.
Oh, okay, I'm on the side of the voice. And drunk. And gay. Go on.
Yes, and so I wonder, you know, the Buddhist view is that these animals are suffering animals because they're limited with their instinct to kill, like the lion, if they're hungry and all of that. But God said the animals were all beautiful birds, you know, pretty colours. We're all put on the earth for our enjoyment.
Yes.
But what would be Buddha's view of the animals then for us on the earth? What would be Buddha's view of the animals then on the earth? Because they're obviously suffering.
So what's, I don't have any question. That's what would apply to humans as well. Why are we here? What are we doing? What are you asking?
I'm asking, what are they doing?
But the
animals.
But sure, it's the same question for humans. As given that we're both continuity of consciousness, the lives are a continuity of consciousness that goes back and back and back. The human has you have a continuity of consciousness back and back. You've been a lion before. The lion's been a human before. So it's the same question for the same being. So ask the question again, freshly now. Don't extrapolate from the Christian one, because that gets you thrown into a certain direction. You and the lion are equal insofar as you are experiencing the fruit of your past actions. It's exactly the same for you and the lion. So if you have a question then, what's your question for both of you? Do you see my point?
Yes.
So what's the question? I don't even have a question.
I'd have to think of one.
That's right, exactly. Okay.
Next question.
Yes,
I
just hand the mic over between the table.
That's easy. I thought Shamita was the key.
No, of course not. It's the key to as long as you practice it now. It's the key to anything. Okay, give it a try. Come on. Would you agree that if you've learned to, you know, you pass grade 12 in piano and you play that Bach perfectly at the front, what are you doing? Give it a mic. So let's say you've done the concert and you've got the gold medal for the top pianist. You've played that piece of Bach beautifully. That's possible, isn't it? Well, you've perfected it, haven't you? So why do we stop playing 10 years later? It's still fairly strongly there, but you've got to really pick it up a lot, don't you? You forget a lot of it, and you have to practice it a lot again, won't you? Would you agree with that? Would you agree with that first?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Say this summer.
I thought it was a realization that once you've got it, you've got it somehow.
Until when?
The ninth stage.
Until when? Got it until when?
Well, I thought that you take it from life to life.
No, of course not. Of course not.
So if you achieve...
You don't really realize emptiness, you cut the root.
If you achieve...
You didn't lose body cheaper, baby. This is the point about realizing emptiness. We have to talk about it because we're realizing emptiness. It's only then, when you cut the root of all delusions, that you cut the seed, and you can't possibly ever after that fall back into misery, and you can only move forward. You can't lose after that anything.
Right.
You can only move forward. You can even lose body cheaper. At a certain point, if you haven't realized anything, I've got what it's never is. Everything just passes, and so only finally you realize anything, you've perfected, you've cut the root of all suffering, now you can't fall back after that because delusions cannot grow anymore. Only virtue can grow.
So if Renee had, or anybody, achieved shamatha when he was 25,
yeah.
Do you keep shamatha for this lifetime?
Well, if you keep practicing, you probably get the right conditions and you can carry on next life. You keep it fresh, you keep going. But you probably have to quickly, if you keep it really fresh and you die well, you're very young and meet the Dharma again, you just get it back pretty quickly. But it's only when you've got emptiness that you can't lose it. It cannot, possible, ever. There's logic to it, you've got to understand that logic by hearing the teaching.
Yeah, I get that about how
you're doing that. Okay, you're mistaken about shamatha, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. Good. Any questions? So let's talk about emptiness, and I keep saying it, I'm going to talk about it, express it, understand it. This is coming to now attacking the deepest delusion.
Excuse me,
Rabina.
Would grief also be attachment not getting what it wants?
Okay, you better ask me about that. What?
I just wondered if grief. Would grief also be attachment not getting
what it wants? We've got to unpack that because I think grief, what the evolution of that word and that emotion is, or that word to describe a certain feeling. But I think, if I understand the Buddhist one, it's a combination of several things together, I would suggest.
Thank you.
So again, put it like this. Let's say you're a highly realized being who has given up attachment and anger and who realized emptiness, realized no self, and you're quite progressive, okay, in your spiritual practice, and your beloved mummy dies. You'll be really sad, you'll cry, but you will not be suffering. It's not possible because you haven't got attachment. So if anything is called suffering, or if it's grief, I suggest that's based upon having attachment, a close karmic connection, as well as sadness, love, compassion, all mixed. And just in that sense, so with the Dalai Lama, for example, when he talks about his mum, tears will come. But he'll crack a joke in about a minute. But if a person's got a lot of attachment, I remember meeting a guy one time who had an unbelievably close relationship with his beloved, you know, and she died. And I met him like 5 years after she died. It was still like she died yesterday. He was broken. He was a half a person. That's not because of compassion. That's because of attachment. His overwhelming, intensive reliance upon her presence in his life and his own happiness. That's a function of attachment. So you'd call it grief, but it's coming, it's polluted and dragged down by attachment. But if you don't have attachment, it'd still be sadness and compassion and empathy and tears, but it wouldn't take a piece of you out. You get my point?
Thank you.
Or let's say you have a beloved, you're in love with them and they die on you, then often what happens is people have guilt about not feeling sad. So they never give up the sadness because it feels like if you start falling in love with someone else, you feel like you're cheating on the person. And so people keep feeling bad because you feel like shameful to start feeling good like you've forgotten them. That's very scary for some people. That's completely attachment. They feel so guilty. Do you understand?
Yeah. Thank you.
What else? Anything? People. So let's talk about this. Emptiness business. So the ego grasping, these three main neuroses, the three poisons Buddha called them. It's like the essence of all the 84,000 neuroses. Buddha says there are basically, he's identified 84,000. He gets it down to three. And you know, this three poisons, or even my own most lovely phrase in the West, toxic emotions, great term. Right? Three mental illnesses, great term, I tell you. So we talked about attachment and aversion, then the effect we want to play out throughout our lives, and all the others, and the jealousy and the other rubbish come as a result of that. But these are the fundamentals, and we can understand even those two we really do well. But the one that informs that they are expressions of, the one that's rooted underneath those, that is informed by, is known as ego grasping. So all the delusions, all the neuroses, all the mental illnesses, all the afflictions, all these words that are synonymous, have the function of being disturbing and have the function of being delusional assessments of something. As long as I put it, all these delusions decorate on top of what is there, layers upon layers of qualities that aren't there. So anger or aversion or despair, depression, it takes its object, me or another thing or a person, and decorates on top of it lots of ugly qualities that the Buddha would say aren't in the person or the event or the thing, but they're projected onto the object by our depression, by our anger. So if I'm angry with my ex-boyfriend, then we know he will look really ugly to me. I will think about him all the time, I will think he's the cause of all my suffering, and he will appear like a monster to me. And if I keep growing that anger, I will want to kill him. If it's depression and you hate yourself, you will want to kill yourself. Well, depression makes you appear disgusting, and anger makes him appear disgusting. So the key question is, well, how is anger a lie? Because he did cheat on me. He did lie to me. That's not the discussion. That's not the issue. No one's arguing with that fact. He did do that. That's fact. But the delusion that comes as a result, because it's based on attachment, which over-exaggerates my importance and my neediness and getting what I want, then anger is a response to that. So attachment over-exaggerates my own self, if you like, and my own needs, and therefore dumps responsibility on someone else. And when they don't fulfill my needs, then anger takes over. So they're all embellishes, basically. So there is a chocolate cake on that plate. But the chocolate cake that a person who hates chocolate cake sees is not the chocolate cake that's there. And the chocolate cake that a person who's attached to chocolate cake sees is not the chocolate cake that's there. So attachment makes it look more delicious than it is, and aversion makes it look more ugly than it is. We kind of know this, but we don't talk like this. Mm-hmm. But we buy into these stories all the time. They're liars. They embellish. They exaggerate reality. So the root delusion, ego grasping, the most primordial, the most subtle, the hardest to identify, the one that informs all the others, what that exaggerates, if we take any phenomenon, is its very, as I said before, its ontological status, its thinness. This sounds very abstract to us, I know it's true. This is where I'm saying it. And this is so primordial that we don't even know what we're doing. It's completely subliminal, completely instinctive within us. It's the deepest, most primordial mistake. So after unpacking and unravel that one, I can have to do the others, and then uproot it, which is this hardest job. So let's look at it in the framework. Look at, this is where we get into how do things actually exist. It's on this point that Buddha diverged from the prevailing views of the time. So basically he's saying, as long as over says, all these delusions, ego grasping, the root one, attachment, aversion, all the others, decorate on top of what is there, qualities that aren't there. It's a really powerful concept. So obviously we have to recognize the mistake in the mind and what it projects. So attachment projects deliciousness, aversion projects ugliness, low self-esteem projects ugly me, pride projects important me. Look at the job, you know. Ego grasping is more subtle and the others are imbued with it. It projects inherent me, intrinsic me, real me, concrete me, uncaused me, solid, set in stone, absolute, separate, independent me. This is abstract, I agree, but this is what we have to learn to understand. And then every other object as well. So let's look at it in the context of the two truths, as they say. This is Lama Tsongkhapa's main way of talking about how things exist. And it's a powerful way to really get clear so we don't end up becoming nihilistic. That's an easy thing to do when we hear about this emptiness business. Like, oh, there's nothing. We've got this weird idea about what it means. So, the Buddha's basically saying you've got to look at things from the point of view of their conventional reality, and then we look at things from the point of view of their ultimate reality. But again, this is not how we talk in daily life, of course. This is the thing. So, we can then see from the conventional point of view, we can see there are trillions and trillions of trillions of different phenomena in the planet. As I say, this planet. Forget the entire universe. So he's saying that these delusions are decorating on all of these things, these different problems, these different qualities they don't have. So we're always not in sync with reality. The object that we think we're cognizing isn't the object that exists there, and the different ways, you know? According to the line of the mind. So here we're trying to identify the root line, what he projects, which is more subtle. So, we look at the two truths. So first we can establish, he says we've got to look into how things do exist. So we first have to establish what exists, and that's this establishing of a conventional phenomenon. So we can see that in the universe there are things called cups, and books, and clocks, and thermoses, and tissue boxes, tables, and cloths, and microphones, and floors, and cushions, and keep going. And we're inventing a million things a day. Look, since Mr. Jobs came into the world, we've invented 40 billion different new phenomena, haven't we? We can't catch up. Well, among all these phenomena, there's another phenomenon called I, a self, a person, a being. They're all synonymous. Person, self, I. Maybe not being. No, you need to leave that one. Person, self, well, maybe being, yeah. Person, self, I, being, they're all synonymous. They're all used to refer to this kind of phenomenon. So we have to establish what a phenomenon is, and I forget what the definition of a person is, but we're trying to establish a cup. And this is already a very powerful point in Buddhist philosophy. What's that, Mom? Don't worry, it's called a cup. What is it? She'll explain. It's flat-bottomed clay container. She'll explain the meaning. Or she'll explain it first. The first part of this definition is conventional characteristics. But I'm not satisfied yet. But money, what does it do? And this is a massive meaning. To understand emptiness and reality, you've got to know the understanding of function. This is very abstract. We've got to know how something functions. What is the function of something? Because that gives its meaning. Meaning means function. So what's the meaning of a cup, money? What does it do? What's its function? Well, really, it holds my tea. That's its meaning, isn't it? It's its job. We believe anything anyone tells us. That's not appropriate. We're so suckers. We believe anything anyone tells us. We're babies, you know? No, you've got to establish reality. So what do we do? She has to prove it to me. She defined it as a flat bottom container that holds tea. Well, prove it, Mum. I'm not going to believe you. So she does. She gets her tea and she pours. And we will both see it fits the definition. It holds my tea. But that's not enough yet. We've got to then check to make sure there's no other valid cognition in the world as we know it that contradicts that cognition. And once we've established that, then we can tick the box, sign off, shake hands, and we can now proceed to agree that phenomenon is an example of a cup, and now we can proceed to discuss a cup. So you learn the definition, I learn the definition, I say, please pass the cup, you'll pass the cup, and we're all together. Easy peasy. That's what we call science. That's established. It's a fundamental point to establish first what something is. And this is the conventional reality. It's already implied in emptiness, if we're clever enough. That by convention, by agreement, this is a cup. By agreement. But the Buddha says we're not happy with that. We don't realize that what he says ego grasping does, immediately and instinctively, it decorates on top of cup a status that it doesn't possess of being an intrinsic cup. Of being a cup, as they say in Buddhist philosophy, that there's a cup out there, there's a cup from its own side, there's a cup in and of itself, there's an inherent cup, an intrinsic cup, like the Greeks would say, like an essence of cup there, the Christians would say, they call it a soul in a person, or even the way the Hindus, they talk about self, and including here, like an essence, there's something intrinsic there that is like its cupness, its ontological status, its cupness. Buddhist says no. Mistake. It's an over exaggeration. It's a bell and whistle. And of course, this is the hardest one to see. It seems ridiculous to say these words. Of course, it's a cup, they all say. So, conventionally, we first establish what it is, and now we can begin to discuss how it exists. Both, and the way to do that is to think about how it does exist conventionally. And so, everything in the universe, Buddha says, exists interdependently. Interdependence, the broad word, interdependence, or the term they use in Buddhism, dependent arising, is the word that's used to refer the way everything conventionally exists. So, and as he divides it, the three ways you divide dependent arising, levels of it. The first one, and this is all our arguments that he was having with the prevailing views at the time, which he also points out as views anywhere in all of our minds. So the first one is that everything that exists comes into existence in dependence upon causes. Cause and effect. Pretty powerful. I remember when I first studied philosophy, when I first became a nun, my philosophy teacher, and when I first became a nun, a couple of years really intensive, as I'm the issue called Geshe studies, you know, like the master's program, and we did a couple of years of that intensive, all day, every day, 5 days a week, full on exams, everything, for a couple of years, and 2 years, you know. Very happy with that, 2 years, so happy. So anyway, we had our classes and we were discussing logic and cause and effect, and my philosophy teacher, Geshe Tekchok, he used the example of a phenomenon called Rabina, which of course is why I remember it. He said, it can be said that everything in the universe, up to the first second of Rabina, is a valid cause and a condition for the existence of Rabina. You can go into it. That sounds pretty cosmic, you know. But if you analyze it, it's really logically true. So it's like if you just think about a cup, you know. It is a definite result of causes and conditions. You can see that very clearly. There's causes and the clay, the difference, the heat, the thing, the fire, the time, the this, the that, all the different causes that produce the cup. That clay came from this, which came from that, which came from this, which came from that. The water came from this, which came from that, which came from this, which came from that. The heat came from this, which came from that. And you can get back to the first moment of the universe. Logical, natural, logical, inexorable. If you really follow it through. Everything's like that. It sounds cosmic. So there's who's going to go there, who cares? So the real point is, what is the experiential implication of the fact that I, as this object called I, is the result of causes? Now that's karma. So that's why thinking about karma, because right as an antidote to the instinctive view of ego, which is expressed, I didn't ask to get born. We say that. That's a perfect expression of this philosophy of believing there's an inherent bit of Rabina in there who has got nothing to do with being Rabina. Someone else made me. Who did it to me? Where are they? They're the blame. That's how ego thinks. It's this mad insanity that we have that thinks everything else is done to me. Everybody else is in charge of me. I'm this innocent victim that got done to. That's ego's way of talking. We believe that. That expresses our philosophy. My mother made me, my father made me, God made me, someone else made me. I'm this product that some other person plopped on this planet. And I know I didn't give them permission. I know I had nothing to do with it. That is for Buddha the exact expression of no cause and effect. I'm this innocent victim. That's insanity for the Buddha. So by thinking about karma, Buddha's view, at least that much, it puts me in the center of responsibility, that I am the main cause of me. That is so tasty. And what it brings is accountability. Unbelievable. It lessens fear. It lessens attachment. It lessens anger. It makes me responsible so I grow up. And therefore I can own the stuff, the good stuff and the bad easily. Without being chased. I'm not done to. So that really does mean you're the boss. It really does literally mean, like Dalai Lama said, we're our own creators. It's a powerful concept. We've got to take time to internalize. This is applying cause and effect, but it's the first logic of dependent arising, which can prove, therefore, there is no poor self-pity remainder, which is ego. Lama Yeshe would call ego self-pity. It sounds so brutal. When we analyze it, we'll see. So second level, let's go to this one. This is a taste of it. The more subtle level of dependent arising. Everything on the universe in the planet exists in dependence upon its bits and pieces, its parts. This sounds really abstract, like who cares, you know? Yeah, things have got parts, who cares? Was a really crucial discussion, this one. So, okay, we have to first establish the parameters of the phenomenon we're about to discuss. So the parameters of the phenomenon called I you know, the I know as Ravina, the person known as Ravina, we can see these are the parameters, isn't it? You know, it doesn't include this one here. And those parts we can narrow it down to two, body and mind. Consciousness, all its bits and pieces, its thoughts, its feelings, emotions, the sensory consciousness, blah, blah, blah. The bits and pieces of consciousness and the bits and pieces of my body. So they're the components of the person. The clay, the this and the that are the components of the cup. These are the components, the parts of Ravina. So, this is what Buddha is saying, roughly like this. This ego grasping, this primordial mistake in our mind, causes us to utterly believe 1,000,000,000% that there is, in here somewhere among all these parts, walking, as my friend Pende says, walking hand in hand with all the other parts, a special little part called I. We believe this with absolute certainty. Our language expresses it. Every thought we have expresses it. The I, the word I, the concept I, is the central player in our internal conversation. So, he says, don't be ridiculous. There isn't a separate, the word is separate, independent piece called I, who runs the show. Don't be silly. There isn't one, and anyway, you don't need one. The other bits and pieces do fine working together to produce experiences. And this is the same logic of the creator concept. That we do fine creating our own reality. We don't need a boss. So the self is like God. It's a boss. We don't need a boss. The bits do fine working on their own. Let's look at this. Let's look at this. Try and see if you can do some logical analysis. That's why in the monasteries, when you study all the stuff and you debate and debate, then you don't meditate on it for the penny to drop, you know? So we've got to do logical analysis. So argue at the grossest level with these ego, with these misconceptions. When you argue with misconceptions, you can get that more deep inside. You gradually get insight into it from familiarizing your mind with these things. So let's do a little kind of analysis, okay? So if I say to you, I have a table, a clock, and a microphone. We've done this before. You're familiar with it, tell you. I have a table, a clock, and a microphone. So it would be reasonable. If when I say that a statement, you hear those words, if you look with your eyes, because you have to look here, because that's where the sound is coming from, and you hear this statement, these words come out my mouth, which represent concepts in my mind, you would hope that when you look, you will find the referent objects of those words. So if you were to do that, how many objects would you have to find? And I'll repeat the statement. I have a table, a clock, and a microphone. How many phenomena are there?
Four.
Thank you. So we have to, you'd hope, if you quickly look now, you'd have to then look and see, yes, there is a phenomenon called an eye, and yes, there's a phenomenon called a microphone, and yes, there's a phenomenon called a table and a clock. We agree, don't we? So the point here is this is where the word dependent comes in now. This is the point. Do you agree, if that's a valid statement, that the fact that we can point out four phenomena means that they're separate from, independent of each other? Do you accept that? So in other words, the clock's function is to tell the time. That's its meaning. That's what it is in its bones. It tells the time. So we all accept, surely, that for the clock to fulfill its function, it doesn't need a table, does it? Do you agree with that? It doesn't need my presence. It doesn't need a microphone or a table. Can we accept that? It can function on its own. It can tell the time. So therefore, it can be separated from the other pieces and can be seen as a separate unit, an independent one, can't it? You accept that? So each of the phenomena is like that, isn't it? Ravina can walk out the door, these bits are fine. The microphone can break, the table still functions. I can die, they're fine. The clock can break, its functions. But that means they're independent of each other. What's the meaning here of independent? There are many meanings of independent. And this plays a massive role in Buddhist philosophy. Do you understand so far? Okay, I'll make another statement. I have a nose, a hand, and a foot.
Mm-hmm.
You agree? Normally, without any analysis, you'll accept that statement, won't you, without argument.
Can you say that again?
I'll say, I have a nose, a hand, and a foot. Without analysis, we'd accept that's a true statement. Here it is, nose, hand, foot. You agree that my cup has a base. You agree with that? Without analysis. But we have to analyse. We have to analyse. We have to analyse. So if that statement is true, that I have a nose, a hand, and a foot, how many? First we establish how many phenomena I mentioned. How many?
Four.
Say them. Just a few. Go. Say them.
That's
four words, isn't it? Four words, and if that's a valid statement, like the previous one, we have to point out four phenomena here that are separate from, independent of each other. Can function, hear the words, function independently of the other phenomena. Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. My foot, its job is to walk, do you agree? Or it could be to kick, whatever. But it doesn't need a hand to walk, does it? Do you agree with that? And you agree that my hand doesn't need a foot to hold a cup of tea, does it? Do you accept? The function of a hand. And my nose to blow snot doesn't need a hand or a foot, does it? Do you agree with that? That's three phenomena so far, isn't it? You agree? Okay, so far so good? So now we have to point out the fourth phenomenon, and hear the words. That's called a self, an I. And we have to point out an I that exists independently of the nose, the hand, the foot, and all the other bits. And Buddha says that's, this is kind of conflating the first two views, but never mind. That he says we believe that there is one in there. We believe it 1,000,000,000%. So now to prove that it isn't true that the eye is independent of the nose and the hand and the foot, it's easy to prove. If you insult my nose, if you say you've got an ugly nose, I say, how dare you insult me? I won't say, how dare you insult my nose, will I? Do you understand? I'll say, how dare you insult me, won't I? Because we confuse me with the parts. So we act as if there really is a separate little piece in there. That in our language, sense, we feel, I have an eye, how dare you use that to me? We say it all the time without question. So the point is this, in the same way the clock is not affected by the broken microphone, because they're separate, the eye, if it were separate, would not be minding if my nose is hurt. If my foot is cut off, my eye won't mind. This sounds so silly, but this is a logical deduction.
Then the foot doesn't function independently of the other parts, because it's kind of...
No, sorry. The foot works beautifully without a hand. I'm sorry.
But it doesn't work without a leg.
No, I didn't say that.
Yes.
I didn't say that. I'm saying a foot, for it to walk, does not depend on a hand.
No.
That's what I said. Yeah. Put it up. That's my discussion. Not more. I didn't say a foot. I didn't say, well, maybe better we put it. Maybe we'd say a leg. A leg doesn't need a hand to function. So a leg does need a foot. You're right, to walk. So they're the parts of the leg. So that's the same as the parts of the eye. So we have to first establish the phenomenon we're talking about. And here we're talking about the four separate phenomena. One piece called eye, one piece called microphone, one piece called clock, and one piece called table. That are distinct and separate and individual in terms of their function. That means they exist separately and independently in a conventional sense. So we think there is an eye in here that is an independent eye because we say I have a hand. That's two things, isn't it? Okay, well if I say, I have a nose, a hand, and a job, and a this, and a nose, and an eye, and an ear, and a mind, and an anger, and love, number the 40 million pieces, there's going to be 40 million pieces. You break them all down, this is a meditation to do, you break all down the parts into component little pieces, like IKEA furniture. We all believe we'll end up with a little secret, little found out, little naked, little self-existent, little eye, and there's now been this down, now been caught, that's been running all those pieces. You won't find that little piece of eye in there. That's a simple way of putting it. But we believe it completely. Or the other mistake we make is, well, all of me is I. That's not possible either. So first of all, as Ramadan says, the owner can't be the owned. So we say, well, it's all I. Well, if it's all I, why would you say, oh, I have a hand? That's two things. This sounds silly initially, but this stuff we've got to debate and learn and then meditate on it for the penny to drop, you know? So again, it's not sounding like fancy intellectual talk, but the point is, what's the experiential implication of this? This is always the point. That's the realization of the of how there isn't a separate I, and the Buddha's saying all our suffering of this ego grasping that clings to a separate I, which gives rise to attachment to get what the fantasy I wants, which gives rise to anger when the fantasy I doesn't get what it wants, which gives rise to jealousy when the fantasy I gets. It's all based on a fantasy. It's all based on a hallucination. Easy words to say. But the discovery of that, the recognition very specifically that there isn't and has never been and couldn't be an inherent, real, inherent, intrinsic, absolute, separate, independent I there. And that's the beginning of the end of liberation, the Buddha says. That's the beginning of the end of fear, of all the nonsense. That's what you can't lose once you've got it, you know. This is the last one to go. This is a simple example. I mean, they debate that for 40 years in the debate yards, and then they take another 40 to get it. So be patient. So this kind of approach, and this is why it sounds so silly to us, just intellectual, but delusions, the Buddha is saying, are primordially deep and completely instinctive, and they're rotten, lousy lies that we totally believe in. So we've got to use incredible, subtle, clever, perfect, detailed logic to argue with them, to establish first intellectually that they're nonsense. And this is not easy, because ego does not want to be argued with. We don't need an eye. Oh, just another little workshop. I like this one. Lunchtime. We'll do it before lunch. Okay. Do another approach to it. So, okay. Let's say I've forgotten how to hold a cup. I've lost my memory. I've got a stroke or something. You have to train me. That'd be a lot of work, wouldn't it? You've got to start writing down all the bits and pieces. I have to learn. There's the thumb and the pinky and the this does that and this and the finger there and the wrist does this and the ligaments and the muscles. It'd be a lot of work, wouldn't it? So I'd have to learn a lot of new things, wouldn't I? I'd have to train my mind. And so there'd be a lot of parts, components involved in that job out there. And because we just got it down, we've got it down, we don't have to learn it anymore. We don't have to learn it again. You'd have to talk about IKEA. You'd have to have hundreds of pieces, wouldn't you? But you'll have to assemble and practice, do all doing their job. Do you agree? So all those bits do their job. The ligaments do their job, the muscles do their job, the pinky does its job, the thumb does its job, the joints do their job. Do you agree with this?
Yeah.
It's true, isn't it? Logically, it's true. It's true. So that's one part of my body. But what's the main player is my mind. So my mind, there's masses of parts of my mind that I have to train. There's my eye consciousness so I can look. There's my ear consciousness so I can hear instructions. There's my attention, I can pay attention. There's my memory. Then there's all of those mechanical parts of my mind I have to really be trained to work together along with the body, all of these hundreds of pieces of Ravina, to work together to simply fulfill the action of holding a cup in my right hand. Do we agree with this?
Yeah.
It's quite intricate and quite fascinating, isn't it? Do you agree? Okay, can you imagine you could really exhaust all the options of all the pieces and you'd write down each piece and their job? You could do that if you really did a long analysis. You could do that. Do you accept that? And you could eventually do the list to the point we've exhausted all the pieces and all their jobs. You've got pieces and their jobs. They've all got their job descriptions. Thumb does this, ligament does that, eye does this. Do you understand? Ear does that. Do you accept that? Could you hear that? And now this is the question. In the action called the Bina holding a cup with her right hand, what is the job that's left that the other pieces aren't doing that the precious little eye can do? The filling left out, which doesn't exist, of course. So what job is left for a piece called I? That's the question. Any answers? Any suggestions? And say whatever you feel, don't worry about it. What job is left over? That all the other bits of my mind and all the other bits of my body aren't doing.
Intention.
Huh?
Intention.
Intention is part of the mind. That's covered.
Enjoy.
Enjoy is part of the mind. That's covered.
Consciousness.
That's part of the mind. That's covered.
No job.
Huh?
No job.
There's no job because there's no part. There's no job left. There's no job left because there's no part left. There's no job left to do because all the other bits are done by the parts. So the parts do the work. But they do them all together to the point where it's so smooth that it gives the illusion of there being one big fat eye or a special little eye that does it all. And our language says that. Our language says, my thumb does that. My finger does that. My attention does that. So we keep assuming there's an owner of those pieces who's like the overseer. That's exactly the analogy they use. And that's how we feel. There isn't such a part. And you don't need one. That's what Buddha's saying. It's exactly like the view of Buddha is you don't need a creator, an overseer. The parts, called the people, called the persons, do their jobs beautifully, creating their own suffering and happiness. This is where Buddha diverged from the prevailing views there. This general idea of selflessness. Yeah.
Sorry, Rebecca, are you saying, so we don't need an I?
We don't need an intrinsic, separate, boss I. There is an I, but not how we think. It's much more subtle than that. We'll go into that after lunch.
Thank you.
Do you understand?
Yep.
It's the independent I that's the key term. And that's still not the subtlest meaning yet. There's still more to talk. The concept is we think there's an independent I in there that's the boss, the overseer, the puppeteer, the landlord, or the owner of the bits, that judges all the bits and runs all the bits. So if you want a boss, like your boss, what's your name again? Redhead.
Michael.
If you want a boss, he's right. Intentionally the boss. I will. That's volition. That's the boss. That starts everything. That is the boss. If you want a boss, it's in the mind. It's called intention. But all the other pieces work together. Just like if your hand's trained, all your fingers work beautifully together. Well, all the parts of your body and all the parts of your mind of the person called Ravina work beautifully together to create happiness and suffering. But we want there to be a concrete eye that runs it all. That's so instinctive, so deep. Yeah?
Would you say it's the same for people who say that they look outside and they say, well, someone must have created this and is controlling it? But there doesn't need to be because it's existing fine on its own.
Which
same
is?
Same kind of idea.
Give an example of a thing which you're talking
about. A god.
Oh, that's exactly the point. Yeah, that's Buddha's view. Absolutely Buddha's view. You don't need a creator. That's exactly right.
You don't need an eye, same kind of thing.
Same, exactly the same philosophy. Precisely. Well done. Exactly that. I remember one time in Kathmandu, I was giving a talk to some Lutherans, very lovely people, who wanted to know about Buddhism. They come to Nepal, you know. They told me about karma. It was very fascinating, this guy. It was an amazing point. How we all create our own reality. We all create our own suffering. There's no punishment, there's no reward. He was very shocked. He said, but how come there's not anarchy among Buddhists? Because the assumption of a creator is you need policing. And that's our instinct in the world. We need policing. We need a mummy and a daddy and a judge. Because we're all naughty, you know. So we want to be policed and judged and rewarded. Well, the Buddha says, I mean, conventionally we need policing. Of course we do. But ultimately, no. We create our own reality. Same concept. Philosophically, the same principle exactly. No creator, no I. Same philosophical concept. Exactly right. Exactly. And this is where Buddha diverged from the prevailing. Even though it seemed as amazing beings, their views were astonishing, so sophisticated, but they still came to the conclusion there was an absolute essence, a source that is the source of the universe, the God one, or the soul, the intrinsic self. That so many advanced ideas, but he went further than that and said, no, we don't even need that. But we can understand that really grotesquely, so we'll discuss more after lunch, okay? So let's have lunch.
2:30 again?
I think so. Do you think it worked well yesterday? Was good enough time for relaxing and spacing out. Okay, this is a little quick little meditation, a little thinking for lunch. So think about in terms of entrance now. All that lunch out there, the different pieces, the peas, the carrot, the veggies, the rice, the plates, the forks, the knives, are all the components of lunch. They're the components of what we call lunch. Okay, so when we think of it again from the point of view there's no inherent lunch there, we'll go into more detail later. And also we'll think of it in terms of kindness like we did before, all these kind sentient beings working together to produce this lunch. Illusory lunch that has its own nature, still functions to nourish us. That's the point now. No contradiction. We're going to go into that later. There's no inherent lunch, but it still functions to nourish us. But put these two together. So we think of this delicious lunch, and we imagine it as big as the universe, and we think of offering it to every single sentient being. And we see them all experiencing the joy of receiving it. Lama Sandhi, Lama Chirvija, Lama Girote, Nikon Gijeva, Lama Te, Lama Namla, Chirpa, Hul. And then we enjoy lunch. And then do the discussion work yesterday. It was nice, it was good, it was useful. Please do. But stay focused. Where are you? What's your name, Mama? What's your name? You.
Yeah.
What's your name?
You can call me
Dekyon. Dekyon, very nice. So don't discuss more advanced things that we haven't heard here. If you want to discuss, only discuss what we talk in the room. Don't get it off to another topic, Dekyon. Are we communicating?
Yes.
Thank you, Dekyon. Where's your coffee?
Malaysia.
Okay. Thank you. All right, people, thank you.